communities. We had one on helping people experiencing homelessness, creating safe streets. We just had one on making enough housing for everyone, about housing production and affordable housing. So you can review all of those, check them out on our website. We're going to have one as the election gets closer on Portland's form of voting, ranked choice voting, and how that will work for voters, because we know that there's interest and folks want to understand how this new system is going to work and what it will mean to elect three city council members for each of the city's four districts. So we're really taking an approach of just what are the major issues, what do people want to learn about, and bringing together panels to speak to that, to share information. We're also in the midst of our endorsement process. So on our website, folks who are running for city council can apply for an endorsement. We're going to be reviewing those applications with the volunteer committees in July and August. So folks, please send candidates you like to them. We recognize how important our next city council is going to be in the role of local government, right? Portland for All is focused exclusively on local government because that's the area that is a volunteer organization. We can have the most impact. And because we know that there's such a role for local government in people's day-to-day lives. We're continuing to stay active in the Multnomah County election, supporting Shannon Singleton in North and Northeast Portland and Megan Moyer in downtown Portland. And as a volunteer-run group, we're really driven by our members, by the folks who want to chip in and participate and help plan things. So please, if you're interested, reach out to hello@portlandforall.org. We can always use more help, more support. We will be active throughout the remainder of the year, doing our policy talks, doing our community conversations, launching our endorsements, and then supporting those candidates as folks who are values aligned, who are going to be those human-centered leaders who are framing a positive, inclusive vision for our future, not a return to the failed policies of the past. And we want folks to join us and to support and lift up that there's a real opportunity right now, but also a decision point. Are we going to have a November election that looks like the May election, where we elected Nathan Vasquez and lost Mike Schmidt? Or are we going to push back on the direction that the city has been going in and say that isn't who we are? We can do better. We can be hopeful and positive and progressive. And I think this is an opportunity for folks to take a stand and come together around that vision and that potential, because this is the year that we have that chance.
So everyone, go to the website again, portlandforall.org. Sign up, volunteer, donate. I've been speaking with Andres Oswell with Portland for All. Andres, thank you so much. All the wonderful work that you're doing on behalf of Portlanders and Multnomah County. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me. And thank you to all the listeners who were keeping in touch, who are staying up to date, and who are continuing to fight.
This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineer, and thank you for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre, a place where quality is key. It's important for the world and future generations to understand the power of art and music. Ultimately, we are doing our part to carry on tradition. Tune into Passing Sound, the first Saturday of each month at 10 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, or KBOO.fm, where we make musical structures for the listener to enjoy.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out. So make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Did
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Today we have a very special guest, somebody who is a fixture in the Bay Area, and so much so that I think we take him for granted until we realize the magnitude of his work, his presence, his commitment, and now the book that he has written, which is called, let me get the full title, What Kind of Bird Can't Fly? A Memoir of Resilience and Resurrection. We're talking about the one and only Dorsey Nunn. We know him for legal services for prisoners with children. We also know him for All of Us and Nunn. We also know him as being a political force. Somebody who I think I probably met you, I want to say almost 30 years ago when you came on my show on KMEL back in the days. And I remember somehow religion came up in the conversation because I think we had some brothers from the Nation on, a few other people if I'm remembering correctly. And I think somebody said something, they didn't believe in Jesus or something like that. And you stayed behind and talked to me afterward and said, man, you know, I grew up understanding, you know, this. That's what I remember. And, you know, I've known you since then. But first thing I want to say about this book, you know, I haven't read the entire thing, but the chapters that I've gotten through remind me of Malcolm X's book. You know, the direction that it's taking, there's like I'm feeling like I'm living the things that you're describing. You know, it just brings things to life, and to see the journey that you're going through from somebody coming out of East Palo Alto before it was even called East Palo Alto. I think you called it East Menlo or something, like Menlo Park, you know, your journey going to prison and coming out is a remarkable one, and in my opinion should probably be required reading for a lot of folks, you know. But I want to talk to you a lot about that. And first of all, congratulations on doing the book. You said for a long time you wouldn't do one. You have Michelle Alexander doing the forward, and you told her she was on you to write a book, and you said you weren't going to do one, and you finally did. What decided? What turned the corner for you?
Hey, Davey D, but me and you both know Manuel. And one day, Manuel, when he was working in an office at Legal Services for Prisons with Children, he pointed out, if I didn't tell my story, somebody else would. You know, all the way up until then, I knew that people would write something about me. You know, if nothing more than the obituary, they would write something about me.
Right.
The other thing that had happened was that when my brother passed, a friend that I was corresponding with in prison bought me every letter that had wrote her from 1974 to 1981.
Wow.
And at that point, when I started going through the letters, it seemed like the stuff that I was talking about, that my life had started to parallel in terms of what I was doing. And I had forgot long since what I had talked about. I can remember her writing, do you have the right to vote? You know, I didn't know I was going to actually get into a campaign about the right to vote, but I had wrote her back, no, I didn't have the right to vote, after I contacted San Mateo County and asked them, did I have the right to vote when I was in prison? I didn't know that ultimately I'd be suing the state of California to help establish the rights to vote for people in the county jail, and further to go on a campaign to establish people on parole securing the right to vote. So it's like stuff like that when I start reading those letters, it was those little things in there that actually start making sense, because I had been on a journey in this trail for probably over 40 years. But it wasn't until I got that material, I recognized some of the stuff that I was called upon to do was more than just, you know, just casually thinking about it. You know, at a certain point in the book, when I get down to, you know, and by the way, there is a community called Menlo Park. And where Black people stayed at on the peninsula in this area, East Palo Alto and Menlo Park. We stayed in the east of the Bay Shore community. And to the most part, it was when we initially moved down here, it was predominantly white. You know, the first chapter of the book is called Innocence Unavailable and Guilt Not Required. You know, because like you be hearing stuff like the presumption of innocence. To the most part, I don't know if Black people were ever entitled to have access to that presumption. From the point of me moving into Menlo Park, probably the first thing that happened was before I had a language and before I could actually read, the thing that I was experiencing initially was blockbusting white flight and redlining. That's what was happening in the community.
You right. know, and engagement with the police.
Yeah, up to a young age.
Let me go back on a couple of things, Dorsey Nunn. One, I want to go back to your conversation with Manuel, right? Saying that if you don't tell your story, somebody would. How I've come to know you is that's a mantra that you've always preached, you know, that formerly incarcerated folks needed to tell their own story. There were a lot of folks that, you know, were literally making a living speaking on your behalf. I'm the doctor with the PhD. Let me tell you about these folks in prison, right? I'm the politician. I'm the social worker, right? And they would speak and literally give you all a politic. And it was oftentimes a politic that would fit their narrative. So suddenly those formerly incarcerated people would be Democrats or, you know, or churchgoers or whatever it needed to be said. And I remember early on, it was like, no, we have to speak our own language. And over the years, I've seen, you know, formerly incarcerated folks become a political force that is unrivaled, you know, from coast to coast. And I think you're one of those pillars.
The basis of all of us are none is we demand the right to speak in our own voice.
Yeah.
You know, but when I was helped building and initiating that campaign on a real level, most of the time that I'm just now looking back at what my work meant. You know, because I was going from cause to cause, issue to issue, and I have never looked back on it, you know. So it's like, how about this? When I said we had the right to speak in our own voice, and they was getting ready to allow me to be the executive director of a legal service, a public interest, a public legal service office, you know, a community-based organization, and I didn't have a law degree. You know, I wish I could say that, you know, I just immediately jumped on it. And I didn't immediately jump on it. I actually had to think about it. And some parts of people that came in, like my son-in-law said, if not now, when? You know, that's the statement that he made. And basically, you talking all this stuff about having a voice and they giving you the primary voice for a legal service office. And why are you hesitating? You know, and, you know, and I was thinking about like, did I want to be responsible for all of these other people, you know, in terms of, you know, the health care, the rent, would I have to stop cussing?
Right.
All that other stuff, because suddenly I became responsible for everybody's situation. And, you know, it's one thing, and I knew that, you know, that I was leading, but I didn't know that I was executive director material, you know, and I was thinking about initially it was like, you know, probably $700,000 to $800,000, you know, and I'm just retiring. And at this point, I think that we had a budget of over $4 million. Mm-hmm. Over the last 6 years, I think that we bought a building that cost $2.5 million, and it was an office building. And, you know, and as opposed to people renting to me, we became a landlord and a subsidized a structure and a subsidized movement. But at a certain point, when I'm talking about people speaking into their own in their own voice, I still see people who fundamentally got life experience and just would automatically defer to anybody with an education, defer to a theory when they got practical experience and they know some stuff. You know, right. So like some other people think, I think I know something. Some other people actually live what they were talking about and they just kept going. So it's like the first document we wrote for All of Us Anon, the document that I wrote was Save Ourselves.
Right. Mm-hmm.
When I wrote that document and I circulated it around, when everybody started just chiming in from coast to coast, that document ultimately became the vehicle in which we built All of Us Anon on. And when we start talking about challenging a narrative, it's hard to challenge a narrative if you don't have the language in which to challenge it. You know, so we became formerly incarcerated people, previously incarcerated people, but by all means people, as opposed to ex-felon, ex-offender, and all the rest of the stuff they was calling us, which was classifying us as something less than a human being.
Dorsey, let me ask you this. I mentioned Michelle Alexander, your friendship with her, and I met Michelle around the same time as I met you. You know,
mm-hmm.
She was down at Stanford, you know, teaching and the whole nine. But one of the things that you point out early on, or I think maybe she did in the forward, in the introduction is you being invited to speak at her class. And you mentioned that even though she had these degrees, she never, you know, flossed like I know more when you had this life experience. That seems to be a very important aspect based upon what you're saying. I wonder how things would have been different if it became the traditional, I have the PhD, you need to learn from me, versus seeing somebody who I actually need to really learn from. Like you said, she had the degree, but you had the experience. And, you know, and I didn't see an exploitative type of relationship, but one that was more like, let me give you a platform. You come talk to my law students and let them learn from you. And I wonder if, you know, how important that was in the trajectory that you would eventually be on.
Hey, when I went to Stanford, and by the way, I had been to Stanford earlier to steal bicycles when I was a kid.
Right. That's what you wrote about.
My shopping over there. You know, they took my bike. I took their bikes back. You know, they took mine first. I took theirs second.
Yeah.
You know, going to being invited into Michelle Alexander's class, there was a couple people that really impressed me that was on the campus of on that campus, and they were younger women, and they were brilliant to the most part. It was like, man, damn, how did I miss this whole pocket of people over here, you know? And Michelle Alexander was one. The other person was Maya Harris. She was there lecturing and doing classes out there too, you know. And when me and George went into the class, because we was in
George Galvez.
And we was cussing like sailors because we had something real to say. And it was a painful to say, you know, and we was telling the story, you know, and I think that she gave me the space to actually tell that story, and I always respected her. Not only did I always respected her, she sent me the galley copy of her book. And I was in Las Vegas, and me and my old lady was in Las Vegas, and we was there to, you know, to get the good meal for cheap price, right. Put some pennies in the machine and get a reasonably priced ticket for entertainment. Right. And I couldn't get out of the room because I was so fixated by reading her book.
Right.
And I immediately
talk about the new Jim Crow.
The new Jim Crow.
Right.
And I picked up the phone, and the first person I called was Susan Burton. Then a couple pages later, Susan Burton appeared in the book. I had to call her back and say, Susan Burton, the book that I got, you in it with me.
Now, who is Susan Burton for people?
Susan Burton is a person, she was a CNN hero. She created a new way of life. She's a force, a real force for the fight for the restoration of women's rights. And she probably had 13 or 14 homes that she's having a transitional home. She's being recognized. The book that she wrote was Becoming Mrs. Burton. And I'm in that book too, you know, and I was in Michelle's book. So at a certain point, I'm hitting these people's books. Why Manuel said, if you don't tell that story, pretty soon everybody done told your story, you know? When I got to Michelle's stuff, I also called the next phone call that I made was to Ethan Edelman that was head of Drug Policy Alliance.
Right. Mm-hmm.
When I made that call to Ethan Edelman, I says, this book is going to be significant. Not that the stuff that she was saying wasn't new, but she had credentials because she had worked for the Supreme Court. She had articulation, which I think that wouldn't be as abrasive as that I was putting out. And I think that she had access. And I told him, because at that point, Ethan Edelman was giving me grant money to actually go talk about the drug war in the Black community. I said, right. You should stop paying me and start paying Michelle, because this book is so important. Because it's gonna have traction. You know, mm-hmm. Then at a certain point, on probably the first run of Michelle Alexander's book, me and Susan Burton bought off the first run.
Wow.
And because we felt like when real decent Black authors come out, that they don't necessarily, they're getting supported by universities and other people. They're not coming to the neighborhood and actually distributing it where. And I requested, maybe $25,000 and took Michelle Alexander on a tour of Sacramento, Oakland, San Francisco, and I think East Palo Alto.
Right.
You know, or maybe Oakland twice. And what I did was start introducing Michelle to a Black community where she was speaking directly to Black people, because I thought that the message she was carrying was so important. That's how right. Me and Michelle gets real tight, you know?
Yeah.
And she also, never talked down to me.
Right, but it's also important because she always says that she really, you know, the basis of it really came from you all, you know? You know, going to a rally or a setting and seeing this is the new Jim Crow, you know, you and George Galvis and others. And I think that's so important because, you know, just being in academia, I've seen people quote stuff that you write and act like it's your own. I've seen them do that with me, you know, things, mm-hmm. And they'll sit up there and, you know, Dorsey, let me tell you, you know, it's all of us or none, and this is what incarcerated, and they'll quote you and act like they discovered it because they're really trying to climb a ladder at all points. And the name of the game is to keep, you know, your source hidden in the back, because then people go, why do I need to talk to you? I need to talk to the source. And I think that, you know, the fact that that wasn't done, you know, that it was like, let me shine a light on these people is, you know, that to me is extremely important, because it allows, you know, this force being you and the people that you brought up, all of us and none, to be something that is transformative. It could have easily been hidden, you know, in the doldrums of academia.
It's like, you know, the all of us and none part, right? You know, when we start fighting structural discrimination, as all of us are not, we didn't necessarily give it that language. Mm-hmm. We wasn't saying structural discrimination, because I can remember, like, when I was struggling to read, learn how to read, and I was cutting my teeth on Solo on Ice, I was thinking about man, who in the hell this brother's talking to?
Right.
It ain't me. You know, I was struggling too hard to get past. You know, at that point, I was only reading Louis L'Amour's cowboy books.
Right.
and watching looking at girly magazines. And then suddenly, the Conrads inside of an institution is introducing me to substantive writings. You know, the autobiography of Malcolm X, Soul on Ice, Ralph Ellison, The Invisible Man, and they introducing me to like concepts, and they teaching me how to read, and they teaching me how to reason. You know, so at a certain point, in this struggle of getting there with Michelle, is that I could understand her language. And to the most part, a lot of people think that, you know, I don't have an education. And when I sit down with professors, I ask them, you know, what was their exploration in relationship to the prison industrial complex, and where did they go for their education? Where I went for mine is I went to El Salvador. Where I went for mine, I went to New Zealand. Where I went for mine is I went to South Africa. Where I went for mine is Cuba. Where I went to mine, Canada, Mexico, all of these places except for Cuba, I was getting admitted into jails and prisons because I had a different route of how do I acquire my education. And once I got to New Zealand and I seen a clenched fist sketched on the New Zealand wall in a Mount Eden prison, and people told me why they was looking like they were Native Americans in terms of the Maori people. They told me that they were black, and I said, like, you know, y'all would be a Latino or some other group, a Pacific Islander. And he said, oh, we became black in 1968 at the U.S. Olympic. That's how come I went to Cuba, because I started questioning, you know, the historical relationship to, you know, what I was experiencing. Like, when I get to that full chapter about, like, innocence unavailable and guilt not required, mm-hmm. At first, when I'm writing a book, and I'm still going through the development of arguments also, I knew that it wasn't accessible to me. You know, when I start thinking about, it was a greater question than just me. When did we have access to that? Since from the point that they actually ended chattel slavery, they start putting things into place that actually was trying to address what they perceived to be a problem of black people stealing and black people needing to feed themselves, you know? So like at a certain point, how far back in that presumption, the denial of the presumption of innocence, that drives the question of why do 90% of the people plead guilty? Because when they get arrested and they sitting in jail, they say there ain't no way in the world that we're gonna go to a jury trial and take it to the box, because we're gonna be found guilty and they're gonna give us 20 years as opposed to the 5 that I can plead out to. I can get out again.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Dorsey Nunn, talking about his book, which is called What Kind of Bird Can't Fly? A Memoir of Resilience and Resurrection. What you just said, you lay this out in these chapters, you know, the mindset, you know, and it's not a, you know, it's not something that's voyeuristic, at least not for me. I think it's something that it's like, wow, you know, I can understand why certain cousins did what they did. I can understand why your daddy did what he, you know what I mean? You can see people in your neighborhood, you're giving voice to something that it's like, I don't understand why you would do that. Why would you think this way? And I think what you articulate, how oppression in all its various forms, whether it's directly impacting you, like when the cops took your bike, or whether it is, like you said, when they had these restricted covenants and real estate agents were creating ghettos, as you laid out, right? And I'm sure at the time you didn't have language for that, but you're giving that not only the language, but you're also giving us a thought process as to, you know, how this can have impact. Which leads me to another question. You know, the vividness of this book, was a lot of it gleaned from these letters that you wrote and kind of forgotten about, like almost like a, it sounds like you were writing, you know, journalistically, like I used to keep a diary, right? So, and my diary became the basis for a lot of what I put in my book, you know, because I would never remember things I wrote as 15 and 16 year old.
The other part of it is what happens when I'm sitting there at 19 and I'm getting ready to get tried? You know, I'm asking some real questions. Well, how long is the expectancy, the life expectancy of a black man?
Yeah.
You know, why am I here? You know, then when I get to prison, when I get to the county jail, in San Mateo County, and then they transferred me to prison, and they transferred me back to Oakland. It was a lot of black people. Mm-hmm. You know, more so than every, you know, all the black people in my high school, more so than all the black people in church, more so than all the black people I had been smoking weed with and going to the concert, and all of them was packed into this space. You know,
that was what was stark when you made that revelation about how many black men were incarcerated. We're talking about the 1970s, 60s, you know. I mean, this isn't, I mean, I wonder how it is today, you know, if that same revelation would be realized.
Hey, how about this? I got to prison in 1971. I got to prison less than a year from when Jonathan Jackson was killed in Marin County. A year less than George Jackson was killed in San Quentin. A year less than the Attica Rebellion. 4 years less than the SLA. And at the end of the term, New Mexico was exploding. Mm-hmm. So, like, that's the era I came through the most violent prison part of the U.S. prison history. That's what I came through at 19 to 31.
Wow.
You know, so like I didn't walk into that place. I hadn't started to shave. I walked in and I was 145 pounds and people was doing curls with that on the yard.
Wow.
You know, so like at a certain point, hey, David D, I swear to you that I had never thought about killing another human being until I entered prison. And it was like, you know, I said, you know, I got a chapter in there, Commitment to Kill. I should have named that chapter Commitment to Kill in Order to Survive.
Yeah. Well, that's very clear in the chapter.
You know,
that's very clear in the chapter. You know, so like what was going on.
You know, if I go to another reprinting, that chapter is going to change, because what I'm talking about is the access. You know, at a certain point, is how do I emotionally shut down? Because I can remember my mom's coming into the visiting room and told me, asked me, you have to be a good little boy. And I said, well, this is not a place for good or boys.
Yeah.
You know, and I was talking to her in a real strong voice with language that was inappropriate. And my father took me to the vending machine. And he says, don't talk to your mother like that. Then he said, and again, don't ever talk to my woman like that. Then, like, you know, because my father grew in stature as a father, human being, and a man, more so when I had started to grow as a man. I started understanding that my father didn't abandon us. He stayed with us when we had a big family. All the trials and tribulations, you know, like people say, like, you know, like when I was walking home in that first part of that bike story, I'm saying, did my father steal the bike? How about this as an analysis? There was white flight and a whole bunch of white people left a whole bunch of stuff unclaimed. Yeah. Nobody ever thought about that. And I'm saying, I'm thinking about this stuff. It's like, man, hold it. Let me look at that picture. My parents didn't walk me to kindergarten because I couldn't find my way. They walked me to kindergarten because they was afraid that people were gonna do stuff to us.
Right, white folks.
Yes, yes. So like how about this? When, you know, at a certain point, they tell all kind of black kids, well, you can be whatever you want to be, or at least you know, for me, it was only things like entertainment and serving their interests. That's the only thing they told me when I was coming up. But there was a different group of people delivering messages, like taking my bike. When I picked up a water sprinkler and I thought was scrap metal, they arrested me and Nate, who eventually taught me how to read when I seen him years later in prison. They took me down to the substation for trespassing when I went to get a ball out the neighbor's yard, because we had moved into East Palo Alto at that particular time, and it was unincorporated East Palo Alto. And then at a certain point, they got me for incorrigible, and that really caused conflict, because I was thinking about, like, did my parents send me to jail? You know, and at a certain point, whatever these other people was talking about theoretical, what was being acted upon me as a person coming through my neighborhood and growing up, the police was identifying me as something else.
You know, the way that you describe what was going on in the peninsula, and people who read this book, just on that alone, to see that this Bay Area has some closets that need to be cleaned, has some skeletons that need to be unearthed. The racism is very palatable, you know, and, you know, there's a saying of, there's policies of abandonment, like, you all live here, we don't care, we're not going to give you no services, just do what you do. That's how I grew up in the Bronx, and there's policies of containment, you know, you cannot cross this freeway, you cannot go, you know, 2 miles over to Stanford, and if we see you, we're going to stop and oppress you in the most, you know, visible and most, you know, hurtful ways. One of the things that I found fascinating was this whole concept of blockbusting. Can you describe this? Because I think that alone kind of cleared the air about a lot of things, because we're often blamed. Like, you all live in East Palo Alto, you all live here, it's your fault, blah, blah, blah. And you don't know that there was a whole game plan.
The whole game plan was when we moved, started moving into a Menlo Park, there was white real estate brokers that was coming in telling these other white people who had bought property that they are going to lose the value of their property. And they were selling in rapid numbers. You know, at a certain point, 5 years after I was in kindergarten in 1960, they held a hearing in San Francisco that started talking about covenants, you know, because, like, at a certain point, I'm not just writing what I feel. I got a co-author that I had retained that was working, was an investigative reporter for the LA Times for 20 years.
This is who co-wrote the book with you.
Yes. You know, and she was the one that wrote the story about Ban the Box. She was the one that followed me into the White House and put me on the front, on the cover of LA Times and all the rest of that stuff. You know, like I had told you, I knew I was going to get wrote about, you know, but I didn't know that, you know, ultimately, what I had to say, I think, is real, real significant, because when people say, well, why do you commit crime? Well, you know, nobody considered that the criminal acts that were being committed upon me, and what inspired me from the very beginning, because if I had went to school where my grandchildren, because they stand, my grandchildren is in a, I got a granddaughter in USC. I got another granddaughter in Arizona State, and I got a great granddaughter in Clark University. Hmm. If they had treated me like that and gave me something different, maybe I would have served a little bit different. And all the way into this point of getting, you know, like, when everybody fled, what else did they take with them? They took quality education. What else did they take? They took employment opportunities. What else did they take? They took access to decent mortgages for everybody else that moved in behind us.
But now, I got to come back to how you brilliantly lay this out, which is, you know, and this is just one small part, but I think it's very important, because it's something that Black folks all across the country had to deal with. You had real estate agents walk in and tell white folks that there's going to be a black invasion and to move. Otherwise, their value of their property is going to go down. And simultaneously, they stopped selling to them in those areas while redirecting anybody black to those areas. So it was like, we're going to make this be the ghetto. We're going to put a freeway in the middle of it. And that's where they live. And this is a whole other thing of urban renewal. I mean, urban renewal kind of coalesces into it because all these communities have freeways going through them. But it's just crazy reading about it in such detail. Even though you said you didn't have language for it, the effect that it had on everybody.
Hey, David D, in my front yard right now, I got an election sign for a sister that just won the Board of Supervisors in San Mateo County, mm-hmm. right? And you realize how long ago that election was, right? The basis in which I still got that sign in my yard is that for San Mateo, we've only had two countywide elected black people in the history of the county.
Wow.
You know,
in San Mateo.
And everybody's playing like, well, hey, we anytime that I'm in the South talking to a brother, I'm saying just because I ain't in the South don't mean I don't know anything about racism.
Oh, no.
Because they feel like, oh, we got the market cornered. Well, they hung black people in California too.
In the systemic erasure, I have a bunch of things I wanted to ask you, but one that stood out was Facebook playing a part in that erasure. You know, erasing one of those pillars in the community that did make a difference. Annetta Harris, I believe her name. You want to?
Hey, David D, when I got married, the house that I'm staying in now, I had put my fiance standing in the fence where everybody used to stand before I came back home, right? Mm-hmm. And I pulled up, I had her stand there in a wedding dress, and I had a horse-drawn carriage pull up and pick her up to bring her to the baseball field in which I played peewee ball and a little bit of Little League there and drove her down to the park where I was standing. When I gave, I took my first dance for the meal, first dance to my wedding, I danced at the recreational center, and it was called Annetta Harris Center. So as they renaming it, other things, some of us are still here because yeah. the impact of Facebook, when I actually took possession and sold custody of the house that I stay in now, the value of the house was $84,000. The value of the house right now is $1.2 million.
Wow.
Man, if I start crying, man, I done lost all of my homies. My neighborhood is not the same neighborhood, and I'm never gonna sell. You know, I got three brothers that come over here three times a week playing pinochle because at one time when they form in the neighborhood, they knocking on, they ask me, would I consider selling? I'll get the mail talking about I'm gonna see, we can make an offer and somebody's looking for, moving to your neighborhood. They sending me the mail. You know, at a certain point, I'm allowing three brothers to play pinochle in my front yard, and they stopped knocking on my door. You know, at a certain point, I was thinking about like, man, maybe I should, lay some Coke 45 and some English 800 bottles on the front yard so they can stop back up off me.
Right. I hear you.
You know, because at a certain point.
Well, it's just crazy because here you have powerful individuals, the Mark Zuckerbergs of their day, of the 60s and 70s, who literally create these enclaves and along with it, it's not like they're giving you serene neighborhoods. They're like, let's impoverish this neighborhood because they're taking almost everything that is needed out of it. Then they come back.
Zuckerberg was the second version of what had happened.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
The first version of that is the invention of the transistor radio. The transistor came first. That's before we had the thing. So it's like the first wave was the development and emergence of a real wealth associated with transistor. It was Hewlett Packard.
That's right. That's right.
You know what I'm saying? So like at a certain point, thank God for Nate teaching me how to read.
Yeah.
He was a real blessing. You know, I talked about when I'm with Angela in the book, and we developing the theory around the prison industrial complex.
Angela Davis, for people who don't know.
Yeah. You know, and one thing that I did extremely wrong. One time we had an event, and I had at my table Angela Davis and Michelle Alexander. I should have bought a decent recording system as opposed to Rubber Chicken.
Right.
So I have made some real critical errors because the conversation that they were having at that time when Angela Davis was acknowledging Rochelle McGee, that was the first time that I heard her acknowledge him during that whole period of time that he was incarcerated. And she was thinking about he had been down 50 years. That's what she said that night when you was the MC that night.
Yeah, I remember that.
You know what I'm saying? So it's the first time that I seen that. And what did Rue say after he came out of getting shot up by the police? How he defined the event that he participated in was slave rebellion.
Yeah.
So the whole time that I'm following me and Angela's having this conversation, it is like, does this have anything to do with slavery? Right? Now, in the middle of me retiring, I got staffed down there in San Diego going to the Democratic gathering. And what we're talking about is ending involuntary servitude.
Mm.
You know, they're probably going to have a mobile billboard going around saying, stop slavery right now. You know, because like, you know, the continuous thread of the stuff that I thought about while I was in prison, it still followed me to the streets. You know, the other thing that the first document that I seen that lived up to the pledge that these brothers was making us take earlier was return to the community an asset instead of a liability.
That's a powerful concept.
That's a powerful concept. And the other thing that they didn't ask me to do, which I pledged to myself, I ain't gonna never forget y'all.
Yeah. I think the other thing in the book is that political awareness. People forming book clubs and political clubs and reading clubs, literally, you would think, you know, from a layman's point of view, this is a good thing. Dorsey's incarcerated. These people are incarcerated. They're reading. They're becoming politically educated, and they're going to come out and be an asset. And what you describe in some of these chapters is that that became a threat. That became the very thing that they wanted to dismantle. Like, get these books out of here. Stop rehabilitation. You know, let's move them into literally like isolation. And you're sitting there going, you know, from a layman's point of view, why would you do that? You're talking about people who need to come out and be better. And as you get better, you're detailing how they're just literally like to this day, like, we're not going to allow you to have any more programming, not going to have you do any more. They were banning books before these states. And what I thought was crazy is that people would find a way to get these books and then handwrite them and then send them to you. You know, people would pass along handwritten, you know, like
I read Blood in My Eye written in longhand.
Yeah.
And I didn't read it in sequential order. I read it based on who was not. You know, well, do you got chapter 3? Well, if not chapter 3, I got a chapter 4. I just finished it. And we were shooting it through fish lines from cell to cell. And we were so organized that people were copying books. They could have just been one book and everybody had a chapter to copy.
But this is This is slavery in itself. Wasn't it against the rules to learn how to read and write? And what happened if you got caught doing that?
Hey, David, like, not if you got caught. People did get caught, and they spent 30 years in the hole. You know, so like when I was fighting long-term solitary confinement, I was fighting for people I had knew that was there in 72 in DVI, and they labeled them as a gang, and what they were doing was political studying.
So reading a banned book as far as the prison is concerned. So you can have magazines that show women
exploited.
Yeah, that's an exploitative. You can keep those, but if you're reading a Malcolm X or Huey Newton or a Soledad Brother, right? You're gonna do hard time. To me, it's like, wow. This is very interesting, and it makes the question I ask is whose watch is this happening on? You know, how is this going down? Who's in charge? Who made these rules? What's the basis of these rules, and why is it continuing in 2024?
Hey, how about this? You know that like the day that they, I was sitting in Sacramento after I got out, and they were passing, putting the R back in the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. I believe at the head of the California Department of Corrections at that time, his name was Ron Hickman. Okay. At the point they was actually doing that, what they was doing was stripping down the resources that was going into rehabilitation. So that the financing, you know, they was funding bullets and barbed wire and not funding books. So, and they were saying that we're going to be a department of California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And at the same time, when you looked at their budget, it was something a little bit different.
Do you see parallels to what is currently happening? You know, things that you all fought for, a Prop 47 getting passed, and you're seeing all the third version of the Mark Zuckerbergs, all this tech money coming in, to, you know, funding to get rid of it, you know,
not only just not get rid of it, you know, like on a real level, when we step out there and start having district attorneys championing change, they're getting rid of whole district attorneys and they pumping millions of dollars into it to do it. So like when they think that, you know, people signed out to get Pamela Price put back on the ballot. You know, how much did it cost a signature for Pamela Price to throw her out than anything else? It could have been like $1 signature, $2 a signature. When it came to doing Pamela Price, let's give people $10 a signature.
Yeah,
and let's employ people from outside of the city to actually attack this person.
Do you know they had undercover cops right here at the Trader Joe's asking for signatures? And then they had brothers that were from like LA up here collecting signatures. I had conversations, you know, with folks and, you know, and little simple things they didn't even know, you know, like, are you from here? You know, and you know, the undercover cops were, they started trying to back and forth me about the, you know, San Mateo. And I was like, wait a second. Then I realized the language and what they were saying. It was like, huh, you know, your language is not regular people speak. You know, law enforcement folks have their own lingo. And then I peeped and I was like, oh, y'all are police officers up here, you know, collecting signatures. That's crazy to me, you know? And so it just was a whole lot of effort. So why are you over here from San Mateo collecting signatures to get rid of the DA? And, you know, and it was like, they had no answer. And then they got shocked when I said, well, I'm a journalist. That's why I'm asking these questions. I think I'm going to start talking about it. And then it became a whole other, you know, different conversation at that point. But it was just crazy, you know, like, how they had, you know, that the extent that they were going through.
How about this? The first intern at Legal Services for Prisoners with Children was Pamela Price.
Was it really?
Yes.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I met Chase Bodine when I went to New York to visit his father while he was in prison and he was a kid.
Wow.
You know, and I'm just now telling my story.
And again, you're tuned to Hard Knock here on the Pacifica Network. We'll have to stop the conversation right there, and we will pick up tomorrow with David E. speaking with Dorsey Nunn about his memoir, What Kind of Bird Can't Fly? A Memoir of Resilience and Resurrection. Again, this is Hard Knock Radio. We'll check you out tomorrow for part two of this conversation. Thank you so much for listening.
Black folk. Black look like a revolution. Look like a family reunion in the park. Black look like it's a different world. Sound like a crawfish ball in New Orleans. Black folk joke around like Martin and got paintings from JJ in the living room. It sounds strong. Look like sacrifice. It'd be flowers blooming in the summertime. Black sound like old songs. Smell like good food. And it tastes like heart disease, but it feels like maize at Jazz Fest. Black sound like something that hurt, like a hard test. Black sound like skin, like something dark. It look like hair, yeah, black sound like rough hair and good hair. Look like history, sound spiritual. Black sound like years, like working, like night. Black sound like money, look like Walmart. Like corner stores, like cash register singing. Black sound like 400 years. Smell like Oprah. Impactful like Martin. Look like Cicely Tyson. Sing like Nina. Got like Serena. Feel like broken homes in Section 8. Black smell like crack and collard greens. Sounds motivational. Feels like church. Look like big Sunday hats and ribbons.
Speaking truth to power, revolution for the people. Beating back fear, wiping away tears. Hard Knock Radio for the people. Hip hop, politics, and culture rule the day. Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Yeah, Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Power to the people. Tales of struggle whisper through the night. Dissecting the system, exposing the lies, empowering the masses, making spirits rise. Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Hard Knock rocking on your radio.
listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
Tune in at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez here on your community radio station,